Hello and welcome to the latest IBAC podcast. IBAC is Victoria's first anti-corruption agency, and our role is to expose, investigate, and prevent public sector corruption and police misconduct. Today we're fortunate to be joined by Dr. Michael McCauley, Director at the Institute of Governance and Policy Studies and Associate Professor in Public Management at the School of Government at Wellington's Victoria University. Good afternoon, Dr. McCauley.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're in Melbourne to speak with public sector managers about ethical leadership and its role in preventing misconduct and corruption. What is ethical leadership and why is it important?
Ethical leadership is important primarily because it's also effective leadership. There's no shortage of studies to show that the more integrity we think our leaders have, the more effective we find them as well. Even more importantly, though, maybe, is that the behaviours that ethical leaders demonstrate are those that we all now recognise as effective behaviours as well. And now, in years gone by, the good leader has been seen as someone who is very task-orientated, who can get the job done, so on and so forth. But I think now there's a much better understanding that the way in which we get the job done as well also matters. And to be clear in your expectations, to be supportive, to display empathy, emotional intelligence, these are all the hallmarks of ethical leadership.
So what practical steps can managers take to strengthen organisational integrity through their leadership?
Well, there's all sorts of things they can do. They can set up integrity management systems to make sure the effective processes and practices are in place, to make sure there's an effective monitoring and evaluation system, to make sure there's ethical competencies built into a performance framework, to make sure there's appropriate reward and sanctions, so on and so forth. But there's also a number of different behaviours that they can model. I mean, just even the bottom line one, the most important ones, have a very highly visible, good standard of conduct yourself, maintain an outward-orientated people focus, be an open communicator, have good listening skills, have a very strong sense of your own personal accountability. These are the kind of the leadership traits, leadership behaviours that you can exhibit as well.
But ethical leadership is just one aspect of preventing corruption and misconduct. While recognising that every organisation is unique and they're going to face different circumstances, what other key building blocks are there of an effective integrity management system?
The key building blocks to an integrity management system are essentially the same building blocks to any kind of management system. An effective IMS needs to have essentially a balance between values and compliance. Organisations that are completely focused on compliance alone don't tend to have ethical cultures within their organisation and don't tend to have ethics embedded within the system itself. There needs to be the appropriate programmes to translate values into action. Traditionally, we see that with things like codes of conduct, but obviously there's a whole host of other things in place. And again, you don't want to focus too much just on the compliance mechanisms alone, because if you go down that path, as I say, you're not going to embed the ethical culture. So the other key building blocks, really, I'd say, are to make sure that, firstly, as many people as possible are as involved in the defining and creating of what those organisational values are. The decision-making process itself becomes really, really important in trying to build that kind of welcoming, supportive, discursive culture. Another thing is to make sure there's tried as best as everyone can to have effective ethical leadership at all levels. It isn't just about senior management and senior leaders, although they are obviously crucial. I've just alluded to the idea of building integrity into continuous improvement, building into performance frameworks, developing the idea of ethical competences, so on and so forth, and to make sure that's appropriately evaluated whenever's necessary, really.
You mentioned ethical competence. Can you expand on that a little bit?
There's a number of ways we can think of competence. If we think of competence in the classic kind of human resource way of knowledge, skills and attitudes, or sometimes knowledge, skills and attributes, depending on your point of view, you can actually model ethical and integrity behaviours into those competences. And these are things you can kind of demonstrate in a personal development programme every year. So, for example, ethical decision making. Do you follow a structured, logical decision making model? You know, maybe one that was already known within an organisation, or do you just follow your own logic? Do you weigh up evidence appropriately? Do you make a judgment that is fair? Do you try and monitor and rectify and minimise the harm that might be caused by your decision? Another one would be perhaps something like moral sensitivity. You know, you can actually measure people and their degree of empathy that they display, or the degree of small p politics sensitivity. You could look at even something like moral motivation. You can look at things like public service motivation and people having an outward focus in their decisions. And you can get people to demonstrate the behaviours and the times that they've displayed that. You know, when have they definitely put the public interest above their own interest? Or when have they put the team first or above themselves?
We often hear about the term setting the tone at the top in terms of ethical behaviour. What does that involve and how does that fit in with what you've been talking about?
It's quite a multifaceted thing, but I'd say there's at least three essential components if we're talking about tone at the top. One is making sure that there are very clear expectations made. You make sure everyone in your organisation knows what is expected of them. Two, you've got to make those expectations realistic. You've got to make sure that people have got something that they can actually achieve and find attainable, and so they'll, you know, they'll feel rewarded and intrinsically motivated on top of that. And finally, number three, and probably the most important, and I think I may have kind of mentioned it earlier, is that you mirror those behaviours yourself. There's nothing that causes unrest more than the smell of hypocrisy or double standards. Nobody likes a leader that says one thing but does something completely different.
So what challenges would managers or organisations face if they're trying to instil these type of values in their organisations?
Well, I mean, the first one is just the challenge of actually embedding an integrity culture. One of the things people, I think, push back a little bit is as soon as you start using the words ethics, morality and integrity and all these things, there's almost an implicit assumption that you're being judged and that something is wrong. Now, building a high integrity culture, you could do that in an organisation that performs very well already. It's not an acceptance or an indication that there's a massive, massive problem. Although, obviously, sometimes there is. So you've got that kind of concern about trying to make sure you're actually being proactive, you're not being reactive, that you're doing things to improve, you're not doing things to try and judge or get rid of a particular problem. And linked to that, the other real challenge, and this is a constant challenge, is that the journey never, ever, ever ends. You cannot stop when you suddenly think, I'm an ethical organisation now. We're marvellous. There's plenty of organisations that have done that and have won awards and all sorts of things, and people have took the foot off the gas, and inevitably little issues emerge. Because the key thing to remember about integrity, whether this is at the individual or the organisational level, is that it is a process of constant reflection. Your moral views and values will have changed in your lifetime. And that's a good thing, and they probably will change again. And there's a myth that moral values are these universal, set in stone, they don't change kind of things. And that's just not true. We do change. Society changes, our expectations change, our workplace changes. And if we are not going to be honest and reflective and listen to other people, as well as inwardly reflect on our own behaviours and values, then we might as well just forget the whole thing.
Now, part of ethical leadership is setting the standard between what's right and wrong. But what happens when that distinction between what is right and what is wrong gets muddied?
Well, I mean, typically this manifests itself either in a clash of values versus behaviour, so people saying one thing and doing another. But more often it actually usually comes around through a clash of different values. So your own individual beliefs against the thing you've been asked to do, or the organisational values versus the idea of what you perceive to be the public interest or the public good. And this can manifest itself in things like noble cause corruption and those kind of areas.
So you use the term noble cause corruption. That could imply that something's positive and that the wrongdoing could lead to a greater public good. But can the ends ever really justify the means? And can deliberate breaches of the law or codes of conduct ever be justified?
The ends rarely justify the means, to be brutally honest with you. Most ethicists have a general rule of thumb that when you're thinking about an ethical dilemma, you think about them in terms of consequences and ends and what will happen. And you also think of them in terms of principles. So what are my obligations? What are the value clashes, etc.? And the general rule of thumb is that principle-based arguments always outweigh consequence-based arguments, no matter what they are, unless the consequences are really, really, really extreme. So the classic one is the torture dilemma. Do you torture a man who's, you know, has information about a bomb in the city? Well, absolutely not under any circumstances, unless it's a nuclear bomb and it's going to obliterate everybody. In those situations, most noble cause corruption situations, you don't even need to have a principles versus a consequence-based argument because the ends themselves are frequently misunderstood or not understood at all. So the classic one, again, the torture dilemma, you don't need to apply the principles of it, the sanctity of human rights, although they're good things to apply. You can simply apply the very factual argument that torture doesn't work.
So going back to maybe a more traditional idea of corruption where there's personal benefit involved, where perpetrators claim that they were undertaking those acts for a noble cause, do you think that reflects a genuine ethical dilemma for the employee, or in your experience, is it more often a way for people to excuse or rationalise wrongdoing after they've been caught?
I think there's another form that it takes. It's more along the idea of I was following orders. In a major organisation, if you don't feel you have the power or maybe sometimes also the authority to say no to challenge, and you feel that you have to blindly obey whatever the directions are that come in your way because you feel you're in that part of the hierarchy, then that's a much more realistic problem, I think, than the traditional idea of noble cause corruption. Because it's things that we find. It's about the power relationships in our organisations, potential bullying, potential intimidation, potential coercion, potential fear, potential collaboration, of course, and collusion. But for whatever the individual motivations may be, there will be environmental factors and structural factors at play in an organisation that allow that to happen or to mitigate against that happening. And that's what we can protect against with integrity management systems.
And for an individual who feels like they're coming up against those type of environmental factors, is there anything they could do in general to overcome them, or are those mitigation strategies going to be different in every circumstance?
Well, I mean, it is obviously all context dependent. The first thing to see is what are the institutional support mechanisms there, and hopefully, if you're in a robust enough organisation, they will be there. There will be a person you can speak with. There will be a hotline you can call. If it's a problem with your line manager, you'll be able to circumvent that and talk to somebody else. But if they're not there, then obviously you need to do the other things. You need to keep records. You need to form alliances. You need to check to see if you're going mad or whether other people are experiencing these things. But that's not easy, of course. It's far better to have the institutional mechanisms in place to, as I say, allow that kind of people have that psychological safety. And that ability to feel not necessarily protected, although protected is important as well, but just kind of comfortable and safe and say, actually, I think there's a problem here. I know where I can talk about it and who I can talk about it with. That's what we need.
But building a culture like that, it's almost an amorphous concept. It's easy to know when you've got there, but if you're coming from an organisation that maybe hasn't had a history of a supportive culture like that, how do you get from that position to where you want to be going?
Well, that's a fantastic question, because that brings us all the way back to the initial part of the circle in ethical leadership. Now, clearly, you know, if you're at the coalface of work, there's probably very little you're actually going to be able to do. But if you've got a little bit of autonomy and a little bit of decision-making responsibility, then you use that as wisely and as ethically as you can. But this is where you require an ethical leader. And this is why ethical leadership is just good leadership. Because it's not a case of having to think, oh, we're building an integrity culture, although you will be doing that anyway. You're just thinking we're building an effective culture, discursive culture, supportive culture, transparent culture, a caring culture. We should work in organisations that are open and supportive, no matter which organisations they may be.
Dr. McCauley, thanks so much for talking with us today and sharing your insights on leading ethical organisations.
Thank you very much.
And that was Dr. Michael McCauley, Director at the Institute of Governance and Policy Studies. For more information about corruption and how to prevent it, go to www.ibac.vic.gov.au or follow us at ibacvic on Twitter.